Good morning, everybody. It's lovely to see you all. Hope I can offer something interesting. I've used the New Revised Standard Version on the references in the Bible on this occasion. So, anyhow, in this message, I mainly want to focus on the story of Joseph and his family. The 12 tribes of Israel stem from Jacob. While he was in the place called Padan Aram, the birth of his sons links together various originally separate groups who federated together to form the nation of Israel. In the ancient Near East, the tie of blood was seen as the closest bond of union, and so the 12 tribes had one common ancestor, Jacob. It's still a strong thing today, isn't it, in the world? The tribal names were originally geographical names of parts of Palestine, but in Genesis they become names of persons. Similarly, the names of towns in northern Mesopotamia became the names of Abraham's family members. Jacob's sons were born of four different mothers. They were Leah, whose sons were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and the only daughter, she was the mother of Dinah as well. The next was Bilhah, her sons were Dan, Naphtali, and next we have Zilpah, whose sons were Gad, Asher. Finally, we have Rachel, whose sons were Joseph and Benjamin. Benjamin, obviously, being the youngest. The following are some interesting facts relating to Joseph's family. In Genesis 35, 16 to 18, we see the youngest son of Jacob is Benjamin, as I mentioned. He was born on the journey from Bethel, while Rachel was still some distance away from Ephrath. That's actually Bethlehem. Rachel had a hard birth, and as Benjamin was born, she was dying. She named him Benoni, but Jacob called him Benjamin for some reason. I don't know. Maybe someone can enlighten me on that bit. Verse 19 states that Rachel died at Benjamin's birth. Now in Genesis 35, 9 to 12, we see in verse 9, God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him. Verse 10, God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall you be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he was called Israel. Verse 11, he said, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall spring from you. Verse 12, the land I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you. Rachel is Jacob's first and greatest love. He shows most affection to her two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. Getting into the story further, anyway, Joseph has two dreams in Genesis 37, 5 to 11. And such pairs of dreams are a characteristic of the narrative here, as the two dreams of Pharaoh's two servants and two dreams of Pharaoh himself. Joseph dreams that his brothers are in the field binding sheaves, as he is himself. His sheaf stands upright and his brother's sheaves bow down to his. And in the second dream, you can see the reference to this is in Genesis 37, verse 9 to 11. This is a quote, as I mentioned, from the New Revised Standard Version. It says in verse 1, "He had another dream and told it to his brother, saying, 'Look, I have had another dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me.'" In verse 10, "But when he told his father, His father rebuked him and said to him, "What kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow down to the ground before you?" Verse 11, so his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. The story of Joseph is contained within the last 14 chapters of Genesis. The position of which Joseph arose is often seen as occurring during the time of Hyksos. That's circa 1670 to 1562 BC. This is seen as a likely period of history when a non-Egyptian could have achieved such status. But as we see in the story, no particular pharaoh is named. However, it has in recent times been argued that the cultural features presented in the story could hardly have existed prior to the first millennium BC. But no specific period in history can be established. So all that being said, really, we don't know where we are, do we? The theme behind the story of Joseph is about a seemingly insignificant son of Jacob, one of his two youngest sons, and his rise to greatness, and the purpose of his rise indeed. The story of Joseph has similarities to the story of Daniel, who was also a wise man and interpreter of dreams. With Joseph's story, sibling rivalry with his brothers features significantly. Joseph, the son of Jacob and the grandson of Isaac, was the 11th son of the 12, and the firstborn to Rachel. He was a thoroughly decent and good person, but like many good people, not perceived to be such by his brothers. Anyhow, you know, when you think of how good Joseph was, and that, as that unfolds in the story, you'll begin to see more of it, and I'm sure you're aware of it already, but I think he would almost certainly be rated amongst the most decent people depicted in the Bible anyway. One point in mitigation of the brothers' attitude towards Joseph, to some small degree, if they had absolutely no inkling as to what Joseph's destiny was, they had no inkling rather, nor their own come to that. But, and it's a big but, no way can the thought of killing Joseph or putting him down the well, as they did later on, or selling him into slavery be justified in any way. So in this respect, Joseph didn't seem to be helping himself with his brothers, as can be seen in Genesis 37, verse 2. Joseph had been caring for their flock of animals with other family members, and following that, he carried bad reports about them to his father. You know, that's a delicate thing to be doing, isn't it? In amongst a pile of elder brothers. Joseph was born to Jacob when he was old, so to some degree it can be understood that he was his favourite, but he loved him more than his brothers. So naturally, this was resented by them, thus causing more discord in the family. It's obviously a lesson to be learned there about favouritism amongst children, isn't it? And I'm sure we're all aware of it. Jealousy becomes quite pronounced when these sort of situations arise, and the resentment can be quite difficult to deal with and create huge problems in families, actually. To digress somewhat. Let's see. Then there's the famous coat of many colours, as traditionally rendered by many, but in fact it was a long robe with sleeves. This item, given to Joseph, was also a sign of favouritism, or it could be seen that way by the other brothers, for sure. Eventually matters got so bad to the extent that Joseph's brothers got to hate him, and wouldn't even speak politely to him. In Genesis 37, verses 5 to 10, in Joseph's two dreams, all the resentment of his brothers is obvious. Younger brothers usually look up to their elder brothers, don't they? The brothers saw his attitude as vain. Anyhow, the story continues. Let's have a look at Genesis 37, verses 12 through 17. Now his brothers, in verse 1, went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. Verse 13, and Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. He answered, here I am. Verse 14, so he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron and came to Shechem. In verse 15 now, carrying on, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, what are you seeking? Verse 16, I am seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock. Further in verse 17 says, the man said, they have gone away, for I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. It carries on anyway further in Genesis 18. The brothers spotted him coming anyway from a distance, and there was hate in their hearts. They devised a plan to kill him and throw him into a pit. But Reuben thought this too extreme and suggested putting him into a well with the intention of returning later to rescue him and take him home to his father. Anyway, in Genesis 37, verse 23 onward, I'm not quoting from it, but it says, we see when Joseph reached them, they stripped him of his coat and threw him into a well. While there, the brothers took time out to eat. At this time, they saw a group of Ishmaelites from a distance. Judah had second thoughts about killing Joseph and suggested selling him to these travellers, which was done in due course. Reuben was obviously unaware of this happening. He must have been out of sight of the group, doing whatever, I don't know. Doesn't say. Because when he returned and saw Joseph wasn't in the well, he tore his clothes in apparent anger. Meanwhile, the brothers dipped Joseph's coat in goat's blood and on returning home told their father that some animal or other had probably eaten him. As you can imagine, Jacob wept uncontrollably, saying he would be forever sad. And he was obviously inconsolable. His youngest son, who we really love so very much. Excessively so, it seems. Genesis 37:36 goes on with the story. The Midianites reach Egypt and sold Joseph to Potiphar, an officer to the king of Egypt and captain of the palace guard. His time under Potiphar, he managed to gain, or rather he had gained, the complete trust of him. Now Joseph, being a handsome man, and before long, Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him into lying with her. But he rejected her, saying, how could he betray the trust and position which Potiphar had made possible for him? And also betray God too, which he mentions. Because God's in there all the time with Joseph, for sure. But in spite of his protestations, she continued to pester him day after day. But Joseph didn't succumb. Eventually, in Genesis 39, 11 to 12, it states in verse 11, one day, however, when he went into the house to do his work, and while no one else was in the house, she caught hold of his garment, in verse 12, saying, lie with me yet again. But he left his garment in a hand and fled and ran outside. This rejection obviously enraged her, so she nurtured revenge in her heart. So she called other members of the household, saying, my husband has brought us a Hebrew to insult us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out loud. On raising my voice, he fled, leaving his coat beside me. Anyhow, to cut a long story short here, she related the contrived story to Potiphar. He, which a husband usually does, believed her. And he was absolutely enraged by it, naturally so. If it were true, you could understand the anger. You'd want to wring his neck, wouldn't you? Physically talking, of course. By this incident, and it culminated anyway, with Joseph being put into the prison where the king's prisoners were confined. The amazing destiny of Joseph continues to unfold while in prison. He finds favour and trust by the chief jailer. Bear in mind, the Lord is always in control, and wonderful it is too. But we can go through a lot of trials, can't we, along the way, and he spent a fair bit of time in prison, it would appear. All the other prisoners under Joseph's care were he was given the responsibility over these people, and he was obviously found favour and trust with this chief guard. Joseph was the one who did everything, yeah? To the extent that the chief jailer took no notice of anything that Joseph was overseeing. Whatever Joseph put his hand to, the Lord ensured its success. Even the obscure occurrences that led to his being enslaved. A great lesson here for all of us. No matter how hard life gets, God is always alongside the Christian. No matter how impossible some situations seem to be, it says in the Bible, doesn't it, he will never leave you nor forsake you. But trials can be pushing you to the limit so very often, and you can sometimes lose concentration. Peter mentioned earlier, sorry to single you out again, Pete, but you know, you ask God, well, where are you? It's sometimes you feel on your own. But rest assured, you're not. He's there all the time. Even that attitude has got to do, that sort of attitude has a lot to do with our destiny and where we're going and what God is doing through us. He wants us to conquer all these negative feelings. And just as Joseph's dreams led to his enslavement, later the imprisonment as well, it later, further on, led to his position of great authority in Egypt. This latter occurrence came about when he was in prison, when he correctly explained the dreams of two of Pharaoh's servants, who were also in jail. In Genesis 40, in due course, Pharaoh had two dreams himself, which greatly puzzled him. Genesis 41, he called upon all the magicians and wise men of Egypt for an explanation of their meaning. This proved fruitless with them. So with this, the chief cupbearer, who was one of those in prison, said to Pharaoh in Genesis 41, verses 10 to 13, once Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. Goes on in verse 11. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own meaning. Verse 12. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation of each according to his dream. In verse 13, it says, as he interpreted to us, so it turned out. I was restored to my office and the baker was hanged. The interpretation of Pharaoh's dream continues in Genesis 41. It's a longish section, so I'm not going to be reading it, because I'm under instructions not to go on too long. I won't tell you where the instruction came from. Pharaoh, on hearing the story, sent for Joseph, who duly explained the dreams thus. He said they represented 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. He went on to suggest measures to alleviate the effects of the years of famine. Anyhow, Pharaoh was so convinced and impressed by Joseph's analysis and his proposed measures that he appoints him to be overseer of the entire project, which extended throughout the entire land of Egypt and beyond. An enormous responsibility when you think about it. I don't think any of us would sort of want to take on such a task, would we? So there was certainly some motivation behind Joseph, as well as God blessing him. He must have had something very special indeed. Anyhow, the lesson for all of us is that miraculous transformation of a situation is possible with our Almighty God. Further in the story, the famine begins to bite, and Jacob sends his 10 sons from Canaan to Egypt to buy grain from the massive Egyptian storehouses. It's a well-known story that we're all aware of. I know that I'm not trying to teach you new tricks or anything, but there's lots to learn from the general story surrounding this whole situation with Joseph. I find it interesting and intriguing when I paused while doing this to consider the ins and outs of what's gone on. And God's hand in there is wonderful. Anyhow, the ensuing narrative, Joseph dealing with his brothers, becomes entwined with his rise to power. Joseph, now at least 20 years older, was not recognized by his brothers, although we know he recognized them. He devises an intricate plan with the sole intention of reuniting his family. Now, what an amazing example that is. After what he'd gone through, what they put him through, so to speak, there was no hate in his heart, was there? Only love being the main motivator. Again, a great lesson to us. When you think of the way in which they treated him, it must have been unbearable, really, in many respects, feeling so insignificant and sort of downtrodden. Anyhow, he'd gone through this over such a protracted period of time as well, all this aggravation and being ignored. Must have been a difficult time prior to his captivity as well. Now, it's difficult to understand why all Joseph wanted was to share with his family the good fortune and wealth which his position had made possible. You know, it's truly an inspiring example, this, isn't it? You know, it's an example, too, of turning the other cheek. Again, we're all aware of that, but do we do it? You know, I find it very difficult. You realise, usually after a situation, that I should have turned the other cheek. And it's too late, you know, the horse is bolted. However, there's always a consequence for wrongdoing. The brothers needed to learn a lesson as retribution for their past behaviour. When I say retribution, of God, not of Joseph. He's not feeling vengeful, but he, for their benefit and from the aspect of God wanting them to realise what had gone on. Anyhow, this story continues and it becomes very interesting. There's great suspense throughout prior to the conclusion. Anyhow, they have to endure quite a lot before the whole story unfolds, the whole thing. However, I haven't got time to go into all of that, I don't think. So eventually, anyway, Joseph reveals his identity to alleviate his brother's fears. He gives them a theological explanation of the reasoning behind their misdeeds. Genesis 45, verses 4 through 8. It says, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come closer to me.' And they came closer. He said, 'I am your brother.'" Bit of a shock. Can you imagine, after all this time? Hang on. You've got to be jesting. "Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." Verse 5. "And now, don't be distressed or angry with yourselves." He's even sort of being gentle with them. It's an amazing sort of opposite reaction to what most of us would be tending to do. "Because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Verse 6. "For famine has been in the land for 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither ploughing nor harvest." Verse 7. "God sent me before you to preserve life for you and a remnant of earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors." Verse 8. "And so it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me a father to Pharaoh." It's an odd expression for somebody who isn't actually a father, is it? "And lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt." To get the fuller value of this amazing story, you really need to read chapter 48 and through 50 as well. But like I say, you could just read the whole story through the Bible, and it would take a long time, wouldn't it? But of course, I wanted to highlight some of the interesting factors associated with life in general, and how trials and difficult situations evolve, and how things come about, and how God's hand is in there, most definitely. The last section of the story, anyway, revolves around Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel by God, and Joseph himself, of course, because it continues through. Jacob, on his deathbed, proves once again to be a great source of blessing. He blesses Joseph's 2 sons yet again, favouring the younger Ephraim over the elder Manasseh. This is followed by a lengthy poem in which he foretells the destiny, not all happy, of each of the 12 tribes. He outlines what is to happen to all his sons in the day after his death. Here's what Jacob had to say of Joseph. Genesis 49:22-26 outlines the blessings which are appropriate to each of the brothers. I'm not going to read it. And in verse 28, they are described as the 12 tribes of Israel. In Genesis 49:29-33, Jacob tells them he's about to die and how his burial is to be carried out. And in verse 33, it says, "When Jacob ended his charge to his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people." That is a quote, that last section. Genesis 50, verse 1 states, "Then Joseph threw himself on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him." Genesis 50:2-14, we won't read it. Joseph explains to Pharaoh the promise he made to his father, which entailed burying him in the field at Machpelah near Mamre in Canaan. Pharaoh agreed to Joseph's desire. He sent him on his journey with all his servants and all the elders in the land of Egypt. So the size of this entourage really must have been something else. So you can imagine the it's an honour on Joseph, really, that he was revered so much in Egypt by Pharaoh himself. Also, all Joseph's family, his brothers and his father's household, only their children were left in Goshen. chariots and charioteers went up with him. It was a very great company, it says. After Jacob's burial, they all returned to Egypt. In Genesis 50, verses 15 through 21, the brothers wondered if Joseph would bear a grudge. No, Jacob had died. They asked Joseph's forgiveness, and he wept when they spoke, and the brothers wept too. In response, quite an emotional thing, it feels to me. I can sense it if you place yourself in that scenario. After all that time, all he wanted was a bond with the family again, like, you know. Wonderful, really. Very emotive. In response to his brothers, Joseph remained as humble as ever and said, "Don't be afraid. I am in the place of God. Or rather, am I in the place of God?" In other words, I'm not God. So he asked him this. In verse 20, it says, "Even though you intended to harm me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people, as he is doing today." And this stems right down from Abraham, don't it, you know? Nation of nation. This is a lesson to everyone about forgiveness, and whatever happens in this physical world, it's not the end of the story, is it? And God's in control. Everything will work out right in the end, no matter how bleak or futile it may seem. We need to be telling ourselves this as we look to God's kingdom. It may seem in our lifetime, and especially take note of Romans 8:28, where it says, "We know all things work together," a well-known verse, "for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose." And likewise, in Romans 8:31, it says, "What then are we to say about these things? If God is for us, who is against us?" Goes on here. Joseph took the essence of these two verses to heart. Apart from Christ, there isn't a better example of trusting in God. Well, at least not that I'm aware of. Because he never wavered, did he? He never wavered from trusting. There's no mention of him being angry at all. Not at all. To round off the story fittingly, in the last three verses of Genesis 50, 24 to 26, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am about to die, but God will surely come to you.'" You know, you think when somebody says, "I'm about to die," in a calm wave, and like, you know, that's what it seems to be saying that, whether it is or not, I don't know, but he's totally in control, totally trusting, no fear of death, no fear of what's beyond. That's how it rings out to me anyway. Where was I? "But God will surely come to you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac and to Jacob." And 25 it says, "So Joseph made the Israelites swear, saying, 'When God comes to you, you shall carry up my bones from here.'" Verse 26. "And Joseph died, being 110 years old. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt." There's many more lessons we could learn from these stories of Abraham right through to Joseph. And it's well worth revisiting them. I found it interesting myself when I put this together. The more I looked into it, the more I wanted to say, really, but I'd be here all day. Anyhow, especially, you know, in reference to patience and in trusting of God. And, you know, this is the crux of the whole thing, isn't it? For us, like, this is the meaning of it, you know, trusting God. That's what we're learning from this. Man may be tested throughout his entire life, but as we have seen in this story today, not as all as it seems to be. It can be extremely complex, often confusing and protracted. But stick with God to the end, and that will be the beginning of eternal joy. hope you gain something from that. Thank you for your time.